is a live presentation of CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
Now here's your host, Brad Pepping.
Good evening. On the program today, we'll be bringing you updates from Copenhagen, where Thea Whitman is on the grounds at COP15, the United Nations Climate Change Conference, and we'll bring you an update on climate change protests in Vancouver. We'll also hear from CKUT's Tarek Jiroberkan, his discussion with Vivian Carley, an analyst at the International Center of Prevention of Crime, about the end of the Canadian gun registry. We'll have all this and your weekly weather forecast coming up this hour, right here on News 101. As we speak, Thea Whitman is in Copenhagen at the United Nations Climate Change Conference as a member of the Canadian Youth Delegation. This past week saw many exciting and momentous actions in Copenhagen, and we turn to Thea's observations and thoughts on how things are going at this point in the conference.
For the UN climate change negotiations.
Our country's identity is changing.
I think we do have a big role.
It's time to act now. It's for your children.
Who is going to do it?
Seal the deal on Copenhagen.
The Canadian Youth Delegation's daily news from the UN climate negotiations.
In today's climate news for December 14th, the last day without severely restricted access to the conference center was packed with action, with demonstrations, international pranksters, policy drama, and a fossil award for Canada. Canadian youth staged two actions today. For the first one, 25 youth delegates walked through the Bella Center hand in hand, quiet as mice in the hustle and bustle. With our CYD logo on the front of our shirts and Canada, lead, follow, or go home stickers on the back, we made our way to the main plenary hall and stood in a line, eliciting smiles and thumbs up from passers-by, until security forced the delegation to disperse. The second action took place after a Canadian press briefing, where young Canadians reiterated our message of the morning, Canada, lead or go home, via a banner and signs reading who we are and what we each value. Our country, traditionally a leader on environmental issues, punching above our weight, has fallen from grace on the international stage, and is increasingly evident at this conference. We're calling on our government to return us to our previous status by committing to meaningful action on climate change. However, the most dramatic event of today was what must be the biggest climate hoax in history, that is, barring climate change denier pseudoscience, and this time, the joke was on Canada. First, a press release was issued stating Canada had increased its emission targets to 40% below 1990 levels by 2020. This is a target that's consistent with climate science, and was allocating significant funds to mitigation and adaptation for developing countries, starting with African nations. Minister Prentice was quoted as saying, "Nobody benefits from a world in peril. Contributing to the development of other nations and taking full responsibility for our emissions is simple Canadian good sense. We want to show the world that Canada is a leader on climate change." If only it were true. While hope glimmered for a moment in the hearts of optimistic or perhaps naive Canadians, a retraction was quickly released by the Canadian government, as many pointed to the international pranksters, the Yes Men, as possible perpetrators of the prank. However, this retraction, too, proved to be false, as was a video of Ugandan negotiators applauding the announcement, as was a Wall Street Journal article reporting on the release. After a statement was finally released by the real government of Canada, Canada was forced to reiterate that, no, our paltry targets are still insufficient to protect the climate, and Canada tied with Saudi Arabia today for third place in the Fossil of the Day Awards, which are given to the most regressive countries at the climate talks. This award recognized our second-last finish in the Climate Change Performance Index released today by German Watch and Climate Action Network Europe. This index evaluates the 57 industrial and developing countries who release 90% of the world's greenhouse gas. Coming second last, better only than Saudi Arabia, which received a rating of zero, Canada is in the world's top 10 emitters, has one of the world's highest per capita rates of emissions at 23 tons per person, and is currently 34% above our Kyoto target. And the Canadian Youth Delegation continued their meetings with leaders or ministers from various political parties and provinces, with a meeting with Green Party leader Elizabeth May. Finally, negotiations today shuddered to a halt and then ground back up to a jerky march when further struggles over whether the negotiations should result in a completely new treaty abandoning the Kyoto Protocol or maintaining and expanding the Kyoto Protocol while developing a second treaty for new updates. The resistance began with African countries, then expanding as China, India, and other countries backed their position. resulting in the cancellation of working groups and more behind-closed-door negotiations. Some parties feel this was counterproductive, losing valuable negotiating time, while others believe that losing Kyoto will mean losing developed country accountability, which is unacceptable, and which is the position that Canada currently supports. Does all this action have you just itching to do something? No problem. It's time for...
CYD Call to Action.
Hi everyone, my name is Jamie Bigger. I am part of the Canadian Youth Delegation and I am sitting here in the main atrium. So what we wanted to say to you today is that what we're seeing here on the ground is that your government does not represent you. It does not represent the majority of Canadians that want Canada to be a climate leader. It doesn't represent the 75% of Canadians that are embarrassed by the lack of climate leadership from our government. And it doesn't represent even its own parliament that voted and passed a motion calling for Canada to commit to world-class science-based climate targets, which is cutting global warming pollution in half over the next decade. Those are the kinds of targets that we need to move forward in these negotiations and get a real deal. So what we're asking you to do today is we're asking you to call your Minister of the Environment, Jim Prentice. His number is 1-866-599-4999. So call that number, ask for Jim Prentice, tell him who you are, and tell him that you want him to represent you in Copenhagen. You want him to commit Canada to a fair, ambitious, and binding deal. Thank you so much. It makes a real difference.
This has been a podcast from the Canadian Youth Delegation to Copenhagen for the UN climate change negotiations. Hear more on iTunes or at cydcopenhagen.org.
Thanks, Thea, for that report. If you want to catch all of Thea's daily reports, you can find them on iTunes or at citizenshift.org/ourpodcasts. We're going to take a quick break now, but stay tuned. When we come back, we'll be hearing from our friends at CKUT for a report on the end of the Canadian Gun Registry. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Want to know what's going on around town? LiveMusicVancouver.com is the Lower Mainland's comprehensive source for live music listings. We've got more than 350 shows listed at any time, and our listings are updated continuously by hundreds of the very people who put on the shows you love. Artist information and MP3s are accessible right from the listings, as are maps and calendars for virtually every venue in the city. All this and tons more totally free at LiveMusicVancouver.com.
Thanks for being with us. We now turn to our friends at CKUT for a report on the Canadian Gun Registry. And for that, here is Tariq Jeroburkan in conversation with Vivian Calley.
Joining us on the telephone line right now is Vivian Carley, who is an analyst at the International Center for the Prevention of Crime. Vivian, how are you this morning?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
We're doing okay over here. We've had a lot of interesting conversations this morning, and I hope that this one is going to be just as interesting and intriguing. Canadian Gun Registry. The bill was called Bill C-391, which passed through the House on November 4th. It amended the Firearms Act that was enacted by the Liberal government in December of 1998. It removed the requirements to register millions of common rifles and shotguns. There is a lot of talk right now about nuclear weapons, about global disarmament, but small arms gun trafficking, that is something that is specifically your dossier.
Well, there's actually great international information out there in terms of organizations that are working to produce up-to-date and accurate information on what's going on in terms of small arms trafficking. And some of them are... IANSA, I-A-N-S-A, which is based out of the UK, and they are probably one of the forefront in terms of people producing the most information internationally. Then are some of the other ones are the Small Arms Survey, which actually we use at the center constantly, and they come out, they have annual publications. They're based out of Geneva. Their annual publications have a theme every year, and they sort of explore different themes related to small arms. And then in Canada, I've been very involved in a student group with Oxfam. They have a control arms campaign and they produce a lot of material that you can refer to. And then Project Plowshare. They do a lot more policy work, so they do a lot of research that is basically pushing for change in policy in Canada. Then we have things like Save the Children and the Coalition for Gun Control, which is very good also. And then, of course, the Fraser Institute, which is known for its stance against the gun registry. So that's a different perspective. So in general, international information is very important and very good. But in terms of in Canada, what I'm seeing is that there's this development of two camps. One is the Coalition for Gun Control, which is for the registry, and the other one is the Fraser Institute, which is against, and there's nothing in the middle.
An Ipsos Reid poll in 2006 that was conducted in the wake of the shooting massacre at Dawson College found 3 out of 4 Canadians want stricter gun control. Bill C-391, this seems to have removed gun control registrations by removing the requirement to register guns. Has the government given Canadians what 3 out of 4 Canadians don't want?
Well, what's interesting, I mean, we did see reaction recently, November 16th, with the anniversary of the Polytechnic massacre. There were several MPs who boycotted. They had a ceremony in Ottawa, government ceremony, and they boycotted because they were so against what was happening in terms of that it actually had passed as a private member's bill. Now it was on the way to the Commons Committee. And yes, the government is not listening to the majority of Canadians. But the problem is Canadians have to put more voice out there. It's been very hard to organize any sort of public protest because, yes, Canadians are expressing that, especially in Quebec. We're very touchy with the issue with the three main sort of public shootings that we've had over the years, but, you know, very few people are saying something about it. I was doing research. I got access to the gun registry, which was quite difficult to get access to. But what was happening was I couldn't use that information. I mean, one study that came out from the Firearms Center, actually, someone found that out of 4.5 million registration certificates, 3.2 million were left blank and unknown.
And the ones that were filled out, in some cases, it was false information that had been provided by the gun owners?
Exactly, and that's exactly what I was facing. It's a complete boycott, and they've admitted it. So this is a major problem that the government, one, is, I think, running away from, that we need to improve it and not completely cut it off. And two, that people need to understand the importance of registering your weapon. Owning a gun is not a right, but it's a responsibility.
The Canadian Shooting Sports Association, obviously one of the special interests that was pushing for the passing of the bill that would remove the gun registry from Canada, they issued a press release on the 4th of November saying that the handgun registry and strict licensing provisions in the Act are unaffected by the amendment, and despite unsubstantiated claims otherwise, public safety will not be compromised. What is your feeling with regards to public safety based on the removal of the Canadian Gun Registry?
I think it is compromising public safety because we see that Canadians feel safer with the registry being there. It took a while to get it to be fully working, but I think it is compromising, and it's a big problem. For me, I think it's a big problem, and it's going to affect public security tremendously.
A 2009 study published in the American Journal of Public Health showed that on the average, 4 out of 5 gun owners are more likely to be shot than somebody who is unarmed or does not own a gun. If we take away the Canadian Gun Registry, what will replace it? What will make us safer? What do Canadians want? And what do you yourself, who is involved in the situation on a daily basis, what do you think can improve the process?
Well, I think the Canadian Gun Registry is one part of the bigger issue of the prevention of crime and violence. That's what it's all about. And what is happening is there's a move away from prevention and, you know, to get rid of the gun registry and trying to, you know, leave it as it is and dealing with the problem after it happens. I think that one is economically better and socially better to deal with prevention. And what prevention means also is dealing with structural issues. And that's where, let's say the gun registry gets eliminated, well, that's where we need to focus our attention. Now, this is not a new issue.
On reinforcing the structure.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. But the idea of poverty and unemployment and not necessarily just, why are people, shooting other people? Why is there violence? Why is there crime? Why are, why are there concentrations of weapons, illegal or legal, in certain parts of Canada? Those are the issues we need to deal with. And The gun registry, you know, for me, I wanted to use the gun registry to map concentration of guns. So where were they, what type of guns, and then look into the structural issues. And that's where we need to go, and that's where the government hasn't gone, and that's where, you know, there's been countless research. I mean, we all know it's there, and we need to do something about it, and that's the next step. You know, we first have to look at the idea of culture of violence, or the gun culture in Canada, and what we see is Canada does not have a very strong gun culture compared to our neighbor. And so, you know, generally the majority of the population is not, you know, does not carry a weapon and all that. But I think in terms of, I mean, the first issue I want to tackle out of that question was the idea of increasing police power and diminishing individual rights. And I think that is a big issue for especially a lot of long gun owners who have their gun for hunting purposes and they don't feel like they're dangerous. And why should the police have access to their address and come and do safety checks and so on and so forth? And I understand that, like I said earlier, in terms of, you know, is this diminishing individual rights? Well, this owning a gun in our Constitution is not, I mean, we don't have a right to own a gun. Therefore, like I said, it's a responsibility. And what happens with responsibilities is we have consequences. And that means police, which is their role, is to ensure public security, to go and do safety checks. Now, this could be for the sake of the individual. For example, the police go to the home to check if the gun is properly locked away. That's really what they're doing for the safety of the individual, for their family, for other people. I don't necessarily see this as a diminishing of individual rights and freedoms. I mean, you sign on, you get a gun for a certain reason under our law, and then you have a responsibility following that. In terms of increasing police powers, yes, there's been, I mean, there was an increase in employment of police, slightly to work at the firearms center and to, you know, follow who's registering and whatnot. But I don't see it as something that's repressive. I see it, no one wants a police state. So in terms of creating this fear and instability in Canada, I think taking away the gun registry, because it's a prevention method, will in fact increase fear and instability. Because we've had it, and now we won't, if we don't have it, what's going to replace it? The government hasn't proposed anything. So I think that's going to increase fear and instability.
Precisely. I think you've hit the nail right on the head. It's increasing the access that Canadians have to guns that will create fear and political instability. Thank you very much, Vivian Carley, analyst from the International Center for Prevention of Crime.
We thank very much CKUT for making that interview available. We now turn to news from Vancouver, and just as an update, on the morning of December 6th, a group of activists occupied the office of MP Andrew Saxon from North Vancouver. Later that day, after having refused to leave in his office, five activists were actually arrested and removed from the office. Among them was North Vancouver resident Laura Yates, who is on the phone with us now. And here is reporter Megan Tricato for Mrs. Yates' thoughts and observations on the protest.
Hi, Laura.
Hi.
So first of all, I just wanted to ask you, what concerns were you hoping to address with Mr. Saxon?
We had a couple of things that we wanted to address with him. And he was the MP that we chose to take the action on for a couple of reasons. One, because he's a conservative. And two, because he's the MP in a riding which has traditionally been held by Liberals, so we felt that there was an opportunity there. As a Conservative, we felt that he has a responsibility to answer to the members of his constituency, which is why I was there, because I have concerns about the Conservative Party's stance on climate change, but also because he's a Conservative, he also plays a part he's also responsible or can answer to the rest of the people living in the Lower Mainland as to the Conservative stance on climate change. So he's got kind of two levels of responsibility there. And we wanted to speak to him about, if he could give us a little bit more information about the Conservative stance on climate change, and we also wanted him to agree to attend a public town hall before the end of Copenhagen negotiations in order to speak to his constituents and other residents of the Lower Mainland about the Conservative stance on climate change.
And if you wouldn't mind, what are your specific criticisms of the Conservatives' stance on climate change?
That they're not forward-thinking or ambitious at all, that they're really actually quite deplorable. In all of the quotations, I know that the Conservatives have spoken a lot about their commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 20 to 25%, which seems ambitious and seems like it's in accord with the Kyoto Accord, which was signed quite some time ago. But in reality, their baselines are set on 2006 emissions levels. So in comparison to greenhouse gas emissions targets, which by other countries and Copenhagen and Kyoto, they were set to 1996 emissions. So the 2006 emissions targets, when they're compared to the 1996 emissions target or levels, are only actually about 3% of what is needed and about 3% of what we would actually be committing to were we to use 1996 as our baseline and what we want to get back to. So although the numbers sound good, in reality, when you get down and do the math, they're really not ambitious at all and definitely not what we need.
So what motivated you personally to get involved in the protests against climate change?
Sorry, what motivated me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, number one, for this demonstration in particular, I am a resident of North Vancouver. And not only for this demonstration in particular, but for other reasons, I have concerns about my Conservative MP. In terms of climate change generally, and speaking to this demonstration in particular that happened, I'm hugely concerned about climate change, and I really feel that the time has passed for just, you know, griping to your friends or family or choosing to walk to the corner store as doing your part towards climate change. Things are happening now because Copenhagen's happening, and we really are at a point where people the world over are experiencing the effects of climate change in their daily lives. And everyone who even has an inkling of an understanding and recognizes that something's going on that they need to stand up for and speak out about, the time is now. It really is now. With Copenhagen happening, there is such an opportunity for change to happen in the world, and I just really felt like I needed to get out and do something. I can't even describe how much I feel that way, and I think a lot of people are starting to feel that way right now because a lot of stuff's been happening the world over. Some leaders of other nations have made these great empowering speeches that really speak to how their people are suffering, and it seems like many people in developed nations really aren't aware of how climate change is affecting people in developing nations, and in some cases even people in their own countries. When you in regards to Canada, people in the north are already experiencing the effects of climate change in their daily life. So it's an issue that really, really people need to stand up and speak out about now.
Given that, how do you feel about the choice that was made to break up this protest with arrests?
Do you mean our choice to stay or the choice of the office to pursue that?
The choice of the authorities to pursue the means to remove the protesters from this MP's office.
I felt at the time that the protest was happening that first of all, I want to say that the office staff that was there in the office was extremely polite and quite kind throughout the day, even though she was presented with some problems by our being there. That being said, I really felt that day like Mr. Saxton and his assistants, one of them that we spoke to in Ottawa, were really just trying to send the message that they didn't want to deal with us. They weren't going to be bullied into doing anything, which was not our intent. Our intent was not to bully or intimidate, but when I spoke to one of his assistants, that's what I was accused of. So I feel that the reason that they chose to have us arrested and removed from the office at 5 when some other protests, people had been in the office for, I think, like 10 hours or something, which is obviously longer than office hours. And in other offices, the MPs, if they weren't there, had actually phoned the office themselves and spoken to the protesters. So I did feel like that it was a decision that was made by, it wasn't made by Mr. Saxon himself, by one of his assistants to deal with us in that way rather than have the sit-in come to a close in some other way. And all that we were looking for was to have contact with Mr. Saxon because we wanted to pose the question to him of whether or not he would attend a town hall, and we weren't demanding a yes. We just wanted him to answer the question whether or not he would attend and engage in some discussion about the conservative stance on climate change. So I do believe that the way that they dealt with us was a message that they were sending to us, definitely.
Do you feel like the decision to arrest protesters in any way undermined your ability to express your freedom of speech or your freedom of assembly and protest?
The way that the police dealt with us, which was also, again, they were really great. They were very polite. They were really informative. They talked to us. There was no antagonism or anything present in their relations with us. And they made it very clear that we were within our rights to be there, and that they weren't there to remove us or interfere in any way until such time as we were asked to leave. So that aspect of it really was put in the hands of the office staff. And at that point, when they asked us to leave and we refused, at that point we were breaking a law. And that's why the police were there. So it really didn't feel like they were there to force it one way or the other, but they were more there to respond to the request of the office staff. And I'm not fully versed in the law, and I may be gullible, I don't know, but I believe them. I feel that the charges that were laid may be somewhat of an inhibition. The charges that we got were fairly severe. It was arrest by trespass, where I learned afterwards that some of the other sit-ins that happened in the country, people were simply charged with mischief or things that were of a lesser degree of severity. Assault by trespass was, I think, the most severe charge that was laid. I don't know how much of a part the office plays in choosing what we would have been charged with.
Well, thanks for letting us know about these events. That's unfortunately all the time we have, but yeah, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Thank you very much, Megan, for that report. And again, thank you very much to Laura for speaking with us today. It's now time for a very quick break. We're going to hear from a public service announcement, but stay tuned. When we come back, we'll bring you your weekly weather report right here on News 101 at CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The UBC Ski and Snowboard Club is a nonprofit, democratic, student-run organization dedicated to promoting the sports of skiing and snowboarding and the associated lifestyle.
We endeavor to make skiing and snowboarding accessible and fun by actively seeking out the best deals and discounts for our members, as well as organizing trips to local ski areas and setting up numerous social events.
Come on one of our legendary trips and explore the glory of riding in British Columbia. Or join us at the bar to discover the true meaning of debauchery. Ask your roommate, ask your parents.